Thank you all for coming. On behalf of the David Davies Memorial Institute of International Studies and everyone here, I'd like to welcome Professor Jeffrey Hosking to Aberystwyth.
Thank you.
Professor Hosking has made his career, as he puts it, working on the borders of political and cultural history. An emeritus professor of Russian history at University College London, his publication record includes early monographs on the pre-revolutionary State Duma and on Russian prose fiction of the 1960s and 70s. Recently, he published two books, Russia, People and Empire, came out in 1997, and Rulers and Victims, The Russians in the Soviet Union, which is 2006, that examined how Russians, instead of being the dominant beneficiaries of the Russian Empire, did not always benefit from their situation, and in many cases, as he put it, suffered from being the main bearers of empire. Now, his recent work is engaged with the idea of trust as a social phenomenon. This was spurred on by the West's attempt to overlay Western political and economic institutions in Russia without consideration of the social trust necessary for their proper functioning. This led him to general questions about the operation of trust in any society, where he has come to the conclusion that historians are too fixated on power and conflict, and that we need to say more about trust and social solidarity. So, on this general theme of the social trust needed to sustain modern economic systems, his talk today is entitled The Credit Crunch, A Crisis of Trust. So please join me in giving a warm Aberystwyth welcome to Professor Jeffrey Hosking.
Well, thank you very much. It's not always that I get introduced with a complete kind of intellectual history of my career. It's rather nice. Okay, well, in one sense, my title today is redundant. It's pretty obvious that the credit crunch, indeed the current economic crisis, is a crisis of trust. But what I'm going to do is partly to sketch in the historical background, because I think the roots of the crisis of trust, go back much further than we usually think. Secondly, I'm going to suggest that this is not just a crisis of trust in bankers, or even bankers and government, but that it's happened because of the way all of us trust in modern societies. It affects the whole society because of the way trust is built into all our social institutions. We, all of us, look for security and try to avoid risk in ways that have helped this crisis to develop. I think that trust, especially unthinking trust, is part of the deep grammar of any society. It affects the ways we think and act. It generates the templates within which people relate to each other and within which they think and feel about how to face the future. And it's only when a crisis takes place that these things come to the surface and we start to re-examine them. Every society, in other words, has, in my view, its own invisible bonds of trust, which change only slowly as society itself changes. Now, I will briefly define trust. I have to say that quite a lot of books deal with trust without defining it, but I am making my own attempt because I think it's quite important to try and define one's terms. I'm defining it in two ways. First of all, in relation to persons, and secondly, in relation to events or fate or the future. So in relation to persons, trust seems to me to be attachment to a person or collective of persons based on the well-founded but not certain expectation that he, she, they will act for my good or at least desist from doing me harm. And then in relation to events or fate, I would define trust as the expectation based on good but less than perfect evidence that events will turn out in a way not harmful to me. And we need such expectations or attachments in order to take decisions and act in almost all circumstances. If we distrust, that influences our decisions and actions no less. Trust and distrust are a constant feature of our social life. They're deeply rooted in the nature of human beings. Even an uneventful life faces us every day with unfamiliar situations and people we have never met before. And we constantly have to take decisions without being able to gather all the information we would need to take them in a completely rational manner. Let me just take as an example, and it's an example I've used a lot, so forgive me if you've heard it before, and that's the question of boarding an aircraft. This is something most of us now do as routine without thinking about it. But of course the consequences of anything being seriously wrong with that aircraft are frightening to think about. So why do we board aircrafts without even thinking about it? Well, first of all, I think we do so because everyone else does so, and we're simply used to it. Secondly, we don't have the time or the skills that we would need to check the aircraft or even to check the credentials of the engineers who're supposed to maintain it or the pilot who's supposed to fly it. We trust, in fact, the airline and the people who work in that airline, and beyond that, the science of aeronautics. But the way in which we exercise that trust depends on the social framework. On the whole, we know that airlines are responsible organizations. And we know that they benefit from advanced systems of technical knowledge. We entrust ourselves to their experts and their expertise, even if we don't know a single person who works for an airline. Even also if we don't know the first thing about aeronautics. In other words, we're placing our trust not just in persons, but in a social institution and a system of knowledge. And the social context is important in another way too. How do we know that airplanes very seldom crash? Well, because when they do, we read about it in the newspapers. That would not be the case if it happened often. But that depends on having a reasonably free media. I remember in the 1960s and 1970s, some of my Soviet colleagues, when I was working a lot in Russia, refused to travel on Aeroflot, the Soviet airline. Why? Because air crashes were never reported in the Soviet press. And of course that created the suspicion that, since the Soviet press was heavily censored, that created the suspicion that actually air crashes were fairly frequent and that it would be risky to travel with Aeroflot. Well, that's one example of the way in which social context functions in considering trust. What about our own society? What are the trust structures which underlie our societies and which, at least in part, seem to have let us down badly recently? Well, the most obviously relevant one is money. Money enables us in normal times to obtain goods and services from people we do not know, have no other ground for trusting, and are never likely to meet again. This is in normal circumstances, I can say. In the 1920s, the Germans went through a period of hyperinflation. In the 1990s, Russia did too. And not being able to put your trust in money actually involves you in all kinds of incredibly complicated social transactions, hoarding things that you don't need but that you think some potential customer might need, and so on. It makes life very much more difficult. It's much simpler to put your trust in money, and in most times and places one can do that. So money helps to generate trust, but it also creates distrust. It creates boundaries, most obviously, between those who have quite a lot of it and those who have little or none. And this is a feature of trust which I'll talk about later in this paper, that it tends to create boundaries. Trust works well within a particular kind of community, which can be very large, consists of a lot of people we don't know, but at the same time it does create boundaries around itself across which distrust is projected. Well, how does money work? We put our trust in it, but it's actually a many-layered system of trust. Let me just go briefly through the layers. Most of the money that most of us possess takes the form of an entry in electronic account records. Behind that is paper money, which of course most of us think of as real money, even though no bank keeps enough of it to satisfy its customers, should they all turn up together to withdraw their funds or to demand gold. I mean, the notes that you carry around with you say that the Bank of England promises to pay on demand the sum of such and such, but the Bank of England, as we actually know, doesn't hold anything like enough gold to cover all the banknotes in circulation. And even if it still did, what can you do with gold? You can't eat it or wear it or warm yourself with it. So money is not a real good or benefit. It is just a symbol of entitlement to a benefit, but a symbol which society trusts, actually, in some circumstances, more than it does paper money or some of the other forms that money takes. So everyday money, which we take for granted, is perched on top of several layers of trust, which we don't notice. They've built up historically. And it's a very good thing they have. It makes our life a lot simpler. But there are dangers in it. In fact, the current demand for gold, the price of gold is relatively high at the moment, shows that in uncertain times, we prefer to descend a story or two in what begins to look like a rickety structure. But it gets much worse than that. Here I need to spend a bit of time sketching the historical background to our current financial and governmental institutions. Modern financial systems originated in the late medieval cities of Italy, Germany, and the Netherlands. And they took money, gold, and indeed paper money, and then ratcheted up the layers of trust, another notch, by issuing large amounts of public debt, which was terribly useful because it enabled them to spend money they didn't have. We now all take it for granted that governments do this. They accumulate debt. But of course, the whole thing about debt is it ever going to be paid back? Why should people lend you money if they don't trust you? That was always the great difficulty that absolute monarchs had. You couldn't trust absolute monarchs because if they defaulted on their debt, how were you going to have any redress? The monarch, after all, heads the law courts through which you might seek to gain redress. And in fact, it wasn't an idle fear either. Monarchs often defaulted. In the 16th and 17th centuries, a number of European monarchs did renege on their debts. By contrast, the city fathers of city-states of Italy, Netherlands, and so on, they were all wealthy men whose reputation depended heavily on their financial trustworthiness. After all, a monarch radiates trust by other means. He wins battles, or he builds magnificent palaces which, you know, project his image as a figure of beneficence and magnificence and so on. But city fathers have to be financially trustworthy, or they're nobody. They could not afford to be seen to be borrowing money irresponsibly. So they made the repayment of debts the first charge on tax revenues. Lending to them was about as safe as anything could be in late medieval life. Now, the first major monarchy to adopt the municipal approach to debt was the late 17th century English monarchy. And it could only do so by ceasing to be an absolute monarchy and becoming a constitutional monarchy. After the overthrow of the Stuarts, through the Bill of Rights of 1689, the great landowners and London merchants bound the new monarch, William III, to constitutional rule. He had to share with Parliament his power over the state budget and over the army and navy, and also his right to declare a state of emergency. He could not raise taxes or float loans without the consent of Parliament. In return, the landowners and merchants, who formed most of Parliament, consented to being seriously taxed. That was their down payment, as it were, for gaining new powers. Now, both sides of that constitutional financial revolution were crucial. I would argue that they laid the foundations both for modern capitalism and for the modern nation state, two crucial frameworks of trust in our modern world, which usually go together. Now, as it happened, the English monarchy, about to become the British monarchy, was engaged in very serious and expensive wars with France, to conduct which the monarch had to borrow huge sums of money with parliamentary consent. So it did float huge new loans, and these were guaranteed by Parliament in the form of the national debt. Those who bought treasury bonds would receive guaranteed annuities for life or for a stipulated period. Since Parliament was elected, had decisive powers, and represented the real wealth of the country, those bonds were as trustworthy as any investment can be. So this was a very good way of mobilising the wealth of the country, of inducing wealthy people to trust you and to make you loans. And it was crucial that this national debt, note the name instead, it's the national debt, That was the name that was always used for it. It wasn't the royal debt or the treasury debt or the state debt. It was the national debt. People identified it with the nation as a whole. And of course, somewhat later, Adam Smith wrote his book, The Wealth of Nations, to describe the way the system worked. And it's crucial that money was guaranteed by the newly established Bank of England, which was able to issue paper money, carrying the authority of the monarchy and parliament and the trust which people placed in them. And again, that greatly expanded the potentiality of the economy. Wealthy people gained far more confidence in investing their money, not only in the bank itself or in treasury bonds, but more widely in the economy generally. That's to say, the new settlement created a framework within which people, for example, found it much easier to establish insurance companies. They're very important expressions of trust in a society. They not only augment people's confidence in the future, but also, of course, generate funds that can be used for investment. Later on, joint stock companies, a stock exchange. In fact, all the institutions that we nowadays take for granted. Very powerful motors for wealth creation based on trust. So in a sense, this was a great success story. But as I've said before, trust has certain characteristics which I will emphasize and illustrate here, not all of them positive. Firstly, we tend to exercise trust beyond the point where evidence suggests it is poorly placed. I would maintain, in fact, that trust is the default option for human beings. They tend, therefore, to exercise it beyond the point at which evidence suggests that it's not well placed. Once, however, we begin to distrust, we tend to flip over completely and to distrust abruptly and cumulatively. I think that's something that one sees in the operation of trust in many different societies. And of course, this characteristic was dramatically exemplified in the early 18th century. As I say, the new financial instruments added an extra layer to the trust already embodied in money. In modern parlance, the whole system was leveraged. People, in other words, would take on debt in order to invest, because they were confident that they would not only get their money back, but would actually make money. But that meant, of course, that in a crisis, it was liable to abrupt and cumulative seizures of distrust. And the first example of this ailment was, of course, the South Sea Bubble, 1720. The South Sea Company was essentially a pyramid scheme of the kind we saw in Russia and Albania in the 1990s, and more recently in the Madoff scandal. Because pyramid scheme, what it does is it pays dividends not out of real profits, which are inadequate or even non-existent, but uses recent investments to pay off obligations to somewhat older investors. In other words, it's a gross breach of trust. Well, in 1720, it became clear what was happening, and the bubble burst. Dividends ceased, South Sea shares became almost worthless, a lot of people had put much of their fortune into it and faced ruin. So the South Sea Bubble was merely the first example of what has been repeatedly confirmed since, that the capitalist economy, based on ever more complex layers of trust, is liable to panics and crashes. And when trust breaks down, it does so abruptly and cumulatively, as we saw with Northern Rock in September 2007, and then the failure of Lehman Brothers and other financial institutions in September 2008, which very nearly brought the entire UK-US banking system to a halt. That's another thing. Trust, both trust and distrust, are extremely contagious. People tend to trust because other people around them are trusting. And when distrust breaks out, it has a similar effect. Another characteristic of trust, as I've already mentioned, is that those who exercise it tend to draw quite rigid borders around it and to project distrust over those borders. Now, the new early 18th century financial system in Britain was definitely for the wealthy, above all for landowners and city businessmen who controlled the finances and the political process in Parliament. And during the 18th and indeed 19th century, you could see quite complicated systems of snobbery in operation in British society, which ensured that families without a good income from land or finance were not fully acceptable in polite society. And as for the poor, they were left in outer darkness. Indeed, they had to bear much of the downside of the new system. In other words, it was a social polarization going on. Issuing treasury bonds was never sufficient to repay the huge national debt accumulated by war. And so interest on that debt was paid partly out of the highest tax rates in Europe, most of which were indirect taxes and so hit the poor especially hard. Furthermore, to obtain collateral for raising loans, landowners would clear tenants with undocumented or short-term tenure off their land to become agricultural wage labourers or to go into the towns and seek employment, and not infrequently, to end in the workhouse. So there was a very sharp division in society opened up by these new institutions. Now, to cut a very long story short, it took a political struggle lasting more than two centuries for that trust to be broadened and democratized. That is, for the taxation system in British society to be more equitable, and for some of the wealth of the rich to be channeled into providing social security, health, and education for the great mass of the British people. In the end, though, by the early to mid-20th century, that did happen. It happened in Britain, and it happened in other European countries too. And as a result, the nation state became the most effective instrument yet devised for spreading risk, redistributing benefits, and underpinning confidence to enable people to engage in economic activity. I call the nation state a public risk manager. That, in my view, is the most important function of the nation state, one which of course has been dramatically exemplified in Britain in recent months and in the USA. And it's a very powerful repository of trust, especially, or certainly not least, for the poor, who, through the nation state and its institutions, are guaranteed at least some access to education, health care, and financial support in hardship. So, that's the basis of the trust structures most of us have in advanced Western societies in the modern world. And actually, they have changed yet again in my own lifetime. Whereas in traditional societies, and indeed up till quite recently, people looked to family, friends, local community, or religious institutions to help them with life's risks. Nowadays, most of us put our faith in savings banks, insurance policies, pension funds, with state welfare as a backup for those least able to make provision for themselves. And note that all these institutions depend on economic growth. None of them will function properly unless there's economic growth. In my view, trust creates its own myths. And the dominant myth in advanced Western societies, including our own, is economic growth, growth in GDP. Most people assume that the most important aim in any society is to create economic growth. And recently we've had some rather interesting books throwing doubt on this, and I'll have something to say about that later. But you'll note in newspaper comment that the current crisis, that people are optimistic when they think economic growth is going to resume, even though that means bad things like rising house prices. Okay, now to look outside the nation state. The funds in which we place our trust, particularly during recent decades, have been investing their resources all over the world to bring a better return on our behalf. So that in one sense we have today a single global financial system. Particularly during the last 30 years, most of us have, in many cases without even realizing it, been investing in countries we've never visited and know nothing about. The pension funds in which we invest, the insurance societies, the mutual funds and so on, they will invest anywhere from Bangkok to Budapest to Buenos Aires, wherever they think there's a decent return to be obtained. And after the great deregulation of financial movements which took place during the 1980s, investments of this kind grew simply hugely. In fact, between 1980 and 1995, investments from mutual funds, insurance funds, pension funds, grew no less than tenfold in a mere 15 years. And much of this was foreign investment, because that often offered better returns. So that financially, whether or not we realize it, and we don't, very often don't, the radius of economic trust had broadened to include the whole world. But of course it was very thin trust, let's say, based for most of us on very little evidence, very little knowledge. It's staking large sums on countries Western investors knew little about, and not fully underpinned by international governance or regulation. I talked about the nation state as public risk manager, but there's no equivalent international institution acting as public risk manager. There are, of course, a few financial institutions. I'll mention them a little later on, but they certainly don't function in their overall kind of canopy role. And of course, on the back of these financial movements, new financial institutions arose, shadow banks, as some people call them, hedge funds, private equity funds, and so on, drawing their resources exclusively from the wealthy. Their operations were secretive, and they were more or less unregulated. And they borrowed huge sums to make their investment. Leverage of 30 to 1 was not uncommon. That's to say, borrowing 30 times the capital base. Obviously on the assumption that the assets they were investing in were going to go on rising in price. Well, in the long term, of course, this investment was unstable because to attract funds it was based on ever-growing debt, which looked at from the other end, of course, means ever-growing credit or trust based on little that was trustworthy. Public risk managers could no longer manage risk, by which I mean nation states. They could no longer manage risk since much of it was international. And in any case, they had no proper means of assessing the risk that was being undertaken, as we now know. The economic growth it fueled was quite largely illusory. Growth today paid for by hoped for growth tomorrow. Now, we shouldn't belittle the benefits from this process, because there were benefits. Developing countries accomplished some valuable projects, while people in advanced countries could look forward to relatively generous and secure pensions. And we all knew that. We invested in that kind of way, and we knew that we were well insured against life setbacks and disasters. Now, of course, bankers did exceptionally well. They took much of the profit from these ventures. And those working in large institutions tended to assume they were too big to fail, that if they got into real trouble, the state would have to bail them out, and that did indeed happen. In other words, a kind of trust bubble built up, which, viewed internationally, benefited Westerners disproportionately and Western financial institutions grossly disproportionately. So, since the massive deregulation of financial systems in the 1980s, several new layers have been added to the sprawling ziggurats of trust that already loomed over the landscape. But as I said earlier, it's not just the bankers or the government that are to blame. Most of us are to blame too, because of the ways we seek security. And also because of our patterns of consumption. Banks and building societies have been advancing their customers more and more credit. Again, I emphasize that's really the financial term for trust, on easy terms, to buy homes, cars, consumer durables, vintage wine, fashionable clothes, foreign holidays. And we've mostly gone along with this. But the most important example of this kind is actually the real estate market. And I want to dwell on that because that's yet another aspect of us all, or most of us, wherever we could, seeking additional security against risk. In the second half of the 20th century, many people in advanced countries guaranteed their future by investing in urban real estate, usually taking out large mortgages in order to do so. Now, real estate meets the need for two forms of security. First of all, obviously, it offers a secure roof over one's head. But it is also a form of financial investment and has become increasingly so in the last 20 or 30 years. In fact, houses and flats have been offering in recent decades a better and safer return than most other forms of investment, so that people have been prepared to borrow really over the odds in order to secure them. And it's worked well for those who've been able to afford them. But as the financial commentator Martin Wolf has pointed out, it has also turned most of us into, I quote him, highly leveraged speculators in a fixed asset that dominates most portfolios and impairs personal mobility. Just to indicate, actually, the extent to which a bubble has built up in the real estate market, figures from the Financial Times in December tell me that in the UK, residential mortgage-backed securities rose, this is almost unbelievable, from a total of £13 billion in the year 2000 to £257 billion in 2007. Now that's partly because the financial institutions I've been talking about had invented new ways of dealing with debt, breaking it up, securitizing them, it was called, breaking them up and offering them further in packages that apparently were not well understood even by the people who issued them. It was supposed to be a device for spreading risk, making banks and financial institutions more trustworthy. And whilst the economy as a whole was growing and prices were rising, it doubtless had that effect. But the fact is, of course, that once there was a serious market downturn, it had precisely the opposite effect. People could no longer trust, banks could no longer trust the assets they held or that their potential partners held. So that, once again, what had been misplaced trust became abruptly and cumulatively distrust, possibly misplaced as well, probably exaggerated, but nevertheless very effective in building up what is now quite a serious recession. By the year 2007, levels of outstanding UK credit were running at more than double the levels of 1929, that's to say, immediately prior to the, what I would call the previous great crash, because I think this one is as serious as the one which followed 1929, or potentially at any rate is. In 1929, levels of outstanding UK credit were 160% annual income, whereas in 2007, they were 365% of annual income. Okay, so this bubble has burst. Trust has turned into intense distrust. Enormous sums of money have to be written off. I think the general picture is clear. But it's not only the economies of advanced Western countries that are distorted. I would argue the international economy is misshapen in similar ways. In the 1980s to 90s, many countries in the developing world went through financial crises caused by the unrestrained entry and exit of international capital. And this reached a head in several Asian countries and in Russia in 1998. Once investors decided that those economies were overextended, that their investments there were not fully trustworthy, they lost confidence once again very abruptly. They started to pull their money out, precipitating bank collapses and sharp price falls in those Asian countries. And several Asian countries appealed to the International Monetary Fund for loans to tide them over the crisis. Now, this is the very purpose for which the IMF was originally created. And when it was created, as a result of the Bretton Woods Agreement in 1944, it was a very effective institution for spreading international risk, for ensuring that countries would not react to financial crises by beggar-thy-neighbour policies, which endeavouring to balance budgets in one country at the expense of other countries. But by the 1990s, the IMF was working in a very idiosyncratic way in line with the so-called Washington Consensus at that time. And it made loans to countries in difficulties only under very strict conditions. They had to privatize most state-owned industries. They had to balance budgets by cutting expenditure. They had to lower tariffs and remove capital controls. And those provisions certainly made it more likely in the short term that those countries would be able to pay back their debts. But the costs were huge. Cutting state expenditure often meant running down hospitals or not building schools, and thus in the medium and long term undermining the potential for economic growth, which is certainly not advanced by an unhealthy and poorly educated population. Lowering tariffs meant damaging native industries, provoking bankruptcies, increasing unemployment. Cutting social welfare exposed much of the population to much greater risk. In Indonesia, when food subsidies and social security payments were cut, riots actually took place in the streets. So, on the one hand, the trust of international financiers in those countries was restored, but at the cost of hugely weakening the population's trust in foreigners, in their governments, and in their own future. So, in other words, the way that the international economy has been run, and incidentally, those countries then deliberately built up huge financial reserves, which then helped to fuel the financial bubbles I've been talking about. So, in a sense, there was a malevolent feedback there. But in general, over the decades, we have ensured that most of the benefits of worldwide trade accrue not to the people who need them most, but to the citizens of relatively wealthy countries. And as I repeat again, it's not just governments and multinational companies that are to blame. We are all responsible, since we have been using the proceeds to insure against risk, to provide for our own futures, and to consume. I won't go into this because it's a huge topic, but certainly one of the results is Islamist terrorism, which proceeds from the perception that international financial, Western financial institutions are devouring the national wealth and resources of Islamic countries, and furthermore spreading a poisonous culture in their countries. That's how the Islamists see it. That's the imagery that Islamist terrorists constantly use. So that even when it functions well, the present international financial system creates huge and ultimately unsustainable distortions, which are especially damaging to the poor, and which spread distrust in the international arena. At the moment, it's not even functioning well, and even many of the rich can no longer feel secure. So the system needs repairing, and while doing so, we should try to eliminate its underlying defects, or at least mitigate them. Now, in working on the history of structures of trust in various past societies, I have come to the conclusion that when there is a serious crisis of trust, the best way to tackle it is to both broaden and democratize trust, that's to say, broaden its radius and allow it to penetrate to lower levels of the population, the less fortunate, the poorer. Today's globalization was built on the foundation of international institutions, as I say, like the IMF and the World Bank, which spread risk, which alleviate poverty, which deal with crises by collective agreement and prevent an economic downturn provoking beggar my neighbor policies. That's the principle. And it's a pretty good principle. Globalization on that basis remains potentially very beneficial, precisely because it can help to spread risk more widely and thus to broaden trust. The richer countries are actually in a position to share the risks of those living in poorer countries. But for this to work, it needs to be real globalization from which people all over the world can benefit. Nowadays, the international economy functions in such a way that it distributes benefits inequitably and actually makes people in the poorer countries worse off. So we need to find ways of broadening and democratizing it. And to be fair, discussions are going on about bringing some of the at least larger poor countries into the governance of international financial institutions. It's very important that that should be pursued. But in advanced Western societies too, the new finance has produced damaging results for our society because of the inequalities it's created. Generalized trust, that's to say our attitude towards other people in general in our own society, seems to have declined sharply in recent decades. Surveys suggest that in Britain, the level of generalized social trust fell markedly from the 1950s to the 1990s. When asked the question, would you say that most people can be trusted? This is obviously a very general question, one that's difficult to interpret, but in any case, in 1959, 56% replied yes. In 1998, the equivalent figure was 30%. So, not much more than half in a period of just about 40 years. In the USA, similarly, when asked that question in 1964, 55% of the population answered yes, but in 1995, only 35%. And furthermore, in both cases, the lowest figure was among young people, which suggests that later generations are growing up less trusting. Now, figures from most continental European countries do show a similar tendency, but not such a sharp fall. And it's perhaps no accident that it's in Britain and the USA that the subjection of social practices to financial criteria has advanced furthest. And these are also the two Western societies, along with Portugal, I have to say, but I haven't any particular information on Portugal. But the UK and the USA are otherwise the two Western societies in which there has been the most marked social polarization in recent decades. Now, inequality, recent research reveals, is closely linked to low levels of generalized social trust. It's fairly easy to see why this should be so. It's much easier to trust people who are like oneself, whether that's a question of ethnic identity or social class. The Russians, incidentally, have a saying, the well-fed will never understand the hungry. And that, it seems to me, is one of the problems. Research suggests strongly that the percentage of people agreeing with the statement most people can be trusted is higher in countries with more equal societies. And furthermore, similar research carried on in the various states of the USA found exactly the same pattern, that in US states with more equal in the distribution of income, more people tended to say that most people can be trusted. And more specifically, again, this research shows that the greater the degree of social inequality, the lower the status of women tends to be. Now, this is a theme I won't go into at the moment, but I think that women are vital for the generation of trust in any society. The social capital represented by generalized trust is, it seems to me, vital for the peaceful life of any society, which is probably why unequal societies have higher rates of mental illness, drug abuse, obesity, and teenage pregnancy, a higher prison population, and lower life expectancy than more equal societies at a similar level of economic development. Well, to draw towards my conclusion, I believe governments should consciously place the generation of trust within nations and between nations at the centre of their policies. In the financial world, we need to look more closely at alternative forms of finance, at cooperatives, mutual funds, credit unions, and indeed also at the microcredit systems originated in Bangladesh, which incidentally work through groups of women. In the international field, both the United Nations and the international financial institutions need to be reformed and democratized so that they better represent the views of more participants in the global economy. Because the challenges that we face in the near future, nuclear proliferation, which Nick has been and will be working on, climate change, terrorism, human trafficking, the narcotics trade, all of these could be more effectively tackled if statesmen worked in a better informed way to create and maintain trust. Now, a worldwide financial crisis may not seem like the best time to grasp this possibility, but I just come up with one more of my precarious generalizations about trust. It actually seems to me that time of crisis is a better time to begin building trust, because the alternatives have become so awful. It often, quite often, takes a disaster, a dramatic disaster or extreme risk of some kind, to open people's eyes to the necessity of broadening and democratizing trust. So I would argue that because the current economic crisis so obviously raises issues of trust, it gives us an opening for looking more broadly at trust in general. And I'll finish with a quote from a very interesting book, Martin Hollis, Trust Within Reason, in which he tries to argue on why it's rational to try and maximize trust within society. He says, "The general problem of trust is one of identifying the bonds of society, of specifying what makes for weaker or stronger bonds, and then of shaping institutions and policies accordingly. That, I think, is what we should be putting at the center of our governmental processes nowadays, both nationally and internationally." Thank you.
Thank you. So, take some questions?
Oh, absolutely. Goodness, okay. Yes. Yes. Demands discussion.
Right. Okay, start with Daniel.
Have you got a piece of paper? Oh, just a minute. Yeah, I've got a piece of paper. No, I haven't.
There you are. No, it's fine.
I'll do it on the back of, I'll do it on the back of the final page. That's all right, yeah.
I'm just wondering about the story that you have about the place of trust within markets.
Yeah.
The idea of having trust in the rule of law seems to me to be quite a reasonable one. But it would seem to me that markets would operate in the absence of trust. And that is something you don't need to have within markets. And that the crisis that you're talking about right now isn't a crisis of trust, but it's a crisis of profitability. And were you to actually have trust, as in were investors to actually have guaranteed trust in what they were investing in, that they would have profitability, you're not actually then talking about reforming the market economy at all. You're actually talking about transitioning to something else.
There's something that's not a market economy.
Because markets couldn't function if you were guaranteed to have a certain level of profits.
Well,
as a necessity, it would seem to me that in order to have market exchange, you have to have trust in contracts, which is guaranteed by the rule of law, but you don't have to have trust that you'll profit from them.
Well, the word trust, as did I say this or not? I can't remember, doesn't imply certainty. On the contrary, it implies something short of certainty. And actually, and therefore, nobody who invests can ever be completely certain, even with contracts and all the rest of it, that they're going to make money or indeed not lose their money. Now, in most cases, of course, one does in fact make money and one doesn't lose one's money and so on. So for most purposes, this will do. But it's trust. Or to put it somewhat more strongly, confidence. Confidence implies a very strong degree of trust, it seems to me. Now, markets, historically speaking, they do not function without some degree of trust. You have to have trust in money, for example. If your market depends on money, then you must have trust that money has certain value and will continue to have a certain value for the transactions that you're going to conduct in a day or a week or a month. Or that if foreign currencies involved, that the level between the various foreign currencies is roughly equal. I mean, if one looks at the way markets spread during the Middle Ages, for example, a very powerful instrument for the spreading of trust was the bills of exchange. Now, that would be taken out on merchant by customer A on merchant B and would be paid at point C in another country by somebody whom that merchant knew and trusted. Without that knowledge and trust, the system would not have worked. It was operated especially effectively by Jews because they were so likely to know Jews in other countries whom they could trust. Without trust, markets function very badly. I wouldn't say they don't function at all because people always need to exchange things, but then you need to have either an economy of gift, which very strongly favours the wealthy, the aristocratic, the people with higher status, much more so than market economies, or you have to have an economy of barter, which is extremely inefficient. So I would say that actually markets do depend on trust, or at least operate far more effectively if there is trust. But that trust is never total. It can't be. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You look.
There are a couple of things I would disagree with. But
well, do this as a discussion.
The characterization of money as a symbol of entitlement is what you're saying.
Yeah.
That's not an understanding that I would have of money. I would see money as a commodity that anybody else has. So you don't necessarily have trust in it as a symbol. It functions in the way that any other commodity happens to function. And its particularly use value is the very fact that you don't have to trust in it. I mean, I guess perhaps, the problem I get is that it seems to me that the concept is very amorphous because it can be used in a number of different ways.
Yeah.
And trust can be confidence, and it can be faith, and it can be a number of other things. And you kind of believe that no harm will come to you, and that's what trust is. But just, I don't know, it doesn't seem to fit for me, for the market economy example.
I mean, I don't think money is a commodity. A commodity is something which has use value. What's the use value of money? It's only useful when you exchange it for something else. So it's a symbol of entitlement or a symbol of a benefit. It isn't a benefit.
But that's precisely if you're talking about paper money, that is precisely its use value. It just happens to have the two characteristics. It's both use value and exchange value.
Okay. I can't agree with that. It seems to me a commodity is something which you can use. Like you can clothe yourself in it, you can eat it, you can keep warm with it.
Or you can use it as a store of value. Represent something that you can't possibly keep in your house, as an example. So you could have £1,000 represents £1,000 of gold. You don't want to have £1,000 of gold in your house, so you keep £1,000.
Okay, our understandings of the word commodity are different.
Can we?
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Chris?
Thanks very much. I was just wondering, again, with how you see trust in. And in particular, how you see it in relation to risk taking in general, and whether you see much of a difference, and if you can sort of explain what that difference might be, and also
difference between risk and trust.
Risk and trust, and also in the situation of the credit crisis, I wonder whether risk. Problems in risk-taking may be able to explain some of the problems of the credit crunch.
Yeah, sure.
As opposed to problems of trust.
Yes. Well, trust, when it's reflexive, when it's consciously chosen, and it isn't always, I make the point, I think a lot of trust is actually unreflexive, and even perhaps unconscious. But when it's consciously chosen, it implies an assessment of risk. No doubt about it. One presumes that when fund managers in insurance companies and other big financial institutions are deciding where to place their money, they assess the risk. I assume that that's the case. Sometimes I wonder now, but that's probably always assumed. Just to take an obvious everyday example. You go out for you have a young child, and your two parents. You go out for the evening. You entrust your child to a babysitter. Now, you presumably know something about that babysitter. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it. But there's always a slight element of risk. You may have mistrusted it. The information may be unreliable. This may be a more unstable person you realize, and so on. So there's always a slight element of risk. It's trust. You're placing your trust in the babysitter. So I would say that when it's consciously chosen, trust involves an element of risk, which has to be assessed. And if it's low but not non-existent, then we can talk about trust.
Okay, Ian?
What does someone have to say about trust as the foundation of markets?
Where does what fit in? I'm sorry?
Sovereignty.
Oh, yes, right.
It's just striking me that you've got this picture of kind of it's kind of held it's all the way down. You go from trust in electronic money to trust in paper money. It's like the bottom chart where they're all standing on a perfectly through space. Sovereignty. Because sovereignty's a bit different from... It's also something where I can't really, pretty much by definition, get my money back. If I loan £100 to Vincent, I want to bank it, it's tonight to run away with it. Then there are things I can do, like get the dealers to go around to his house. But if I
can get
the government that money, then I don't have that kind of redress. So it's sovereignty.
Yes, you're right.
It's sovereignty trust relationship would vanish if we stop it.
Yes, you're quite right. I didn't talk specifically about sovereignty. I probably should have done because, of course, one of the things that happens is on a coin or on a banknote, you have the figure of the sovereign. And that's a symbolic representation of trust, actually. I mean, this is what's meant to guarantee that this money is really worth something. You can put your trust in it. The figure of the emperor or the king or the queen is on it. And in fact, in the late medieval cities I was talking about, they would quite often put some generally recognized symbol of the city from which it was being issued. Florence, for example, which issued florins with... I'm afraid I've forgotten exactly what the symbol was, but it was a well-recognized symbol of the city of Florence, because that meant, symbolized the fact you were placing your trust in the institutions of the city of Florence. And that, as it happened, was a very widely accepted currency in late medieval trade. So sovereignty is indeed crucial. And when I was talking about the nation state as public risk manager, that's in a way what I'm implying. That's one of the tasks of the sovereign in the modern world, is to act as public risk manager.
Is there anything about any sovereignty that's not being that? Can we then improve that idea of trust as well?
Well, I think sovereignty is very important, and that, of course, is what makes creating international structures of trust very difficult, because we're not going to have an international sovereign, at least I hope not, because that would be pretty disastrous. So I think it leaves us with a theoretically quite difficult question of how to create international structures of trust without an international sovereign. It already arises, after all, in the field of law. How can you guarantee the enforcement of international law where there's no international sovereign? And this is indeed very difficult. It's a very serious problem. It's not much one that I know much about, but I see it as parallel in some ways to the problems I'm talking about. So yes, I quite agree with you. I think sovereignty is important.
Any other questions?
Just following up that point, just a bit thought, but on Ian's. So Norma O'Neill says in her brief lectures, I think the first one, that ultimately there's nothing to back trust but trust itself. And I just wondered, in a sense, it's, you know, sovereignty is there because there's all this that already presupposes some trust structure, and so in a sense, what is it that backs trust? And Laura would say that ultimately, when you kind of strip away all the safety nets, all that backs trust is trust itself.
I don't actually remember her saying that, though I can imagine it. As I said, I think that trust is the default option of human beings, that actually most of us, not all of us, but most of us in most circumstances will incline to trust rather than distrust in kind of ordinary social intercourse. And in that sense, it may be true, in the sense that when we feel reasonably secure, when we're operating in social setting that we kind of understand and can read fairly easily and so on, most of us will trust other people. But I don't feel myself that is enough, because quite often one does have to operate in unfamiliar social settings or with people who one doesn't know, or in circumstances which are quite threatening or risky. Even in a fairly uneventful life, this happens, and a lot of us lead quite eventful lives, and especially, of course, in international relations. I would think that's definitely insufficient. I feel rather with Hollis that the way to strengthen trust is to try and identify the bonds within society which embody it and strengthen those, and in a crisis to broaden or democratize them. If you look at some of the things which do, in fact, symbolize and strengthen trust in society, well, money plays an ambivalent role. As I say, it does seem to me mainly a symbol of trust. Law is another. Somebody mentioned the rule of law, and I agree about that. I mean, law is ineffective or meaningless between enemies, and it's not required with close friends or family, but with everyone in between, let's say the great majority of humanity, law is actually very useful as a backup regulator of social relationships. I think governments and sovereignty play a useful role here. I think certain international institutions, which I've been talking about, play a useful role. So I wouldn't myself say that trust is itself a sufficient basis for trust, although I see what she means.
Is law a backup or is law ultimately there because of trust? If Will Bain was here, he'd have an argument to that.
I mean, obviously, in one sense, law can be an indicator of distrust. I mean, let's say you don't go to law, you don't sue somebody unless you distrust them. But the very fact that you've got law to back it up means, for example, you don't have to go to war. I mean, in a lawless society, you defend yourself by different means. I mean, look what happened in Russia in the 1990s. Companies would defend their interests by creating squads of heavies. You know, and instead of suing another company, you'd send your heavies around. Well, I mean, that's one way of settling differences, but I'm sure most of us would prefer the law, even if the law sometimes indicates distrust. But I think as a backup, law is quite effective.
As a backup to trust?
Yeah, as a backup, when trust can't operate.
But at the same time...
It helps to restore it.
You couldn't have law without trust.
You can't have law without... Where there's total distrust, law is ineffective. That's clearly true. But where there's anything less vicious than total distrust, it seems to me law can be useful for repairing relationships where trust has broken down or become minimal. That's what I would say.
Ken?
I've got a couple of questions about the meaning of trust. I've got a lot more too. I'll give you a couple I've sort of agonized over this concept rather unsuccessfully. I wondered whether you'd come out with the proposition that trust is the default option of people if your social context was a favela in outside Rio rather than your social context being in academic life in London.
Sure.
That would make a big difference. And I was thinking about what would an evolutionary psychologist say about your proposition that trust is the default option of human beings. And my guess would be that mutual self-interest in the struggle of the first humans, in a Darwinian sense, the struggle for survival, which was the game, and reproduction, which was the prize, that it was all about mutual self-interest, not something we could put the word trust to. So I want to challenge the idea, I think, that it's the default position. It might, through socialization, I mean, this goes back to the Rio as opposed to London thing, it might, through socialization, become the default position of some humans in some context, but I'm not sure about it as a general proposition, because if you make it as a general proposition, it means that trust is an instinct, like wanting to eat, or it's an emotion, a basic emotion, like fear. And so, I mean, I think I'd want to see trust as something that evolved in the human story. It's a feeling that we developed at some point, rather than make the very bold comment that it's the default position of human beings.
Yeah.
That was the first point.
And I thought that was the second one. First one was about the favela, but I guess that's the same point, really.
That's the same point. And then the second point was you had this notion of thin trust, which I think is quite interesting. And I wonder whether, again, whether trust is the appropriate word when we're thinking about trusting in, for example, banking institutions. Because it seems to me that this is trust, you want to use that word, that is so thin that it's not trust. Because what you're trusting in when you're trusting in a banking institution or bankers is you're trusting in their self-interest. You're trusting in their self-interest to do things with your money. And I'm not sure that trusting in somebody's self-interest is worth, you know, what is quite an interesting word, trust. I mean, can't you think of something else, like, you know, you can be confident that they'll, which might be stronger, a stronger feeling or attitude, as you suggested. confident in their self-interest, because all humans are to some degree self-interested, because we've got to eat, for example. So I wondered whether trust is, if you're only trusting in self-interest, whether it deserves the concept of trust, or whether it should be something like confidence. Because I could say, I think I would say, I have confidence in bankers, but I don't trust them an inch.
Right, okay. Well, I've actually drawn up a threefold classification of trust. I'm trying not to have too many categorizations, but this one does seem to me quite important. There's a minimal level of trust, which is merely predictive, and that's perhaps what we have in bankers. That's merely that we can forecast the ways they're going to act. Their habitual actions create a social framework within which we can take decisions and act, even if we sometimes don't like them. The second level of trust is what I call fiduciary, though that's open to question, which is trust in someone's competence. You trust someone to do a good job on your behalf. And the third level I would call normative, that's to say when you trust someone because of their good moral character. And I think those three levels are somewhat distinct, and it is questionable whether predictive trust is really trust, but I would suggest that we do in fact entrust people with benefits largely on that basis. We use the word entrust about it too.
It's not really trust in relation to the original definition of trust, which was about acting for my good. Because bankers are only acting for my very narrow self-interest.
Yes.
You know, we probably don't vote the same way. We probably don't like the same films. We probably...
But they will act for my... They will act for my good in that they will keep and indeed increase my money. I mean, out of their self-interest, of course. Adam Smith, you know, the famous thing about the butcher and the baker don't provide me with meals because they love me, but they're acting out of self-interest. But you can nevertheless trust them to do so if you've got the money to pay them.
But do you want to call it, you know, acting for my good, which is more like your normative bit of what trust is all about? I mean, my good is broader than, you know, getting a better percentage on stocks and shares.
Well, I am admittedly talking about trust in a social context. In fact, everything that I'm writing is about trust in a social context. I'm not talking so much about trust in personal relationships, except insofar as they're within a broader framework. And I think that's reasonable because we do, in fact, place our trust in institutions about which we know very little. I mean, for 41 years, every month, I paid a substantial sum of money into a pension fund, as no doubt you have too, without getting a penny in return. And the return was indeed postponed for 41 years. Now, I didn't know anybody in that pension fund, and I certainly had no grounds for supposing that they were acting morally or that they had any particular interest in me and so on. But it seemed to me that I could, with confidence, place my money in that institution. And here, obviously, confidence and trust overlap to a very considerable extent. So I think, in fact, in practice, we do trust a lot of institutions about which we know very little. That's all I'm asserting. I can see grounds for challenging that, and I understand what you're saying. But the reason I think it's important is, otherwise we can't identify properly the bonds which hold our society together, which is the thing I'm concerned about. Evolutionary psychologists and trust in very adverse circumstances. Well, I base my assertion that trust is the default option of human beings largely on the work of child psychologists, notably Erickson and Bowlby, who did their work a long time ago, but I don't think it's been seriously challenged, that human beings begin by trusting their parents, and that through that trust they broaden out to later trusting relationships. Now, of course, this doesn't always work. But that's the whole point about this kind of explanation, is to show that where an initial relationship between a child and a carer or a parent
is poor, then later relationships tend to suffer too, and distrust tends to grow out of them. And obviously also something that creates distrust is adverse circumstances of any kind, poverty, racial discrimination. You know, there are plenty of things which help to generate distrust. I'm saying no more, I think, than that the initial tendency of human beings is to trust, but that it can easily, in certain circumstances, be turned to distrust. And very strong trust can be turned to very strong distrust, quite suddenly. That's really what I'm saying. As a matter of fact, I was reading Robin Dunbar, who I think is an evolutionary psychologist, if I've understood him rightly, and he gave a lecture at British Academy last year in which he said that the two faculties which really distinguish human beings from animals are A, telling stories, and B, religion. Now, both of those things, well, actually they're linked, of course, are used to create trust. Telling stories is one of the things that helps to strengthen bond between a child and an adult, and indeed the links between human beings, and religion likewise. I would actually add one or two other things, like music, which seems to me to be widely used in society to help create bonds of trust where they're weak or non-existent. I mean, liturgical music, military music, dance music, all exists to help strengthen bonds.
The odd thing about what you just said, though, is that where I come from, telling stories.
Yeah.
Our parents told us not to come and tell stories, because telling stories is by definition telling lies.
Well, that's right, of course, that is sometimes used in that sense, isn't it? And of course, telling stories can also, I mean, it may strengthen community solidarity, but it's quite often stories that are hostile about outsiders. So, like other forms of trust, it creates boundaries very often. Religions like this. Nick, you were about to answer.
Yeah, just a few things that are bouncing off kind of the discussion between you and Ken there. Do we have to make a distinction between the kind of trust that Hollis is talking about when he talks about trust as bond, and the trust that we place in these bankers and financiers who we don't know? I mean, we may have these institutions mediated through individuals, and that might affect, I mean, we talked about this earlier, that might affect how we think about those institutions. But it seems to me it's a different kind of trusting relationship that you place in an institution than the ones that you might develop in your interpersonal relationships.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about child psychology and so on.
Yes.
Relationships one builds up with close family members and then with friends and so on. And then, you know, potentially then with close business acquaintances and all the rest of it in the business world and the international politics world, relationships between leaders. It seems to me that's a different character in terms of trust than the kind of relationship where it's an individual placing in an institution. And that might be something worth thinking about. And in that regard, I mean, I think this idea, the definition of trust that you're working with in terms of, you know, we trust in the banking institutions to look after my good, as you put it. Seems to me that that's very close to this. We talked about this earlier, but people in the group will know this because this has been a recurring kind of theme in our discussions. So that's very close to Russell Hardin's encapsulated interest model, I think, where, you know, he talks about interest being encapsulated in the two parties. And Hollis would say that that's not trust. I mean, I really can here. Because he's saying that the problem with it is that the players are only trusting one another for as long as it serves their interest to do so.
Mm.
And as soon as that changes, if they then weren't to trust one another, well, Hollis would say, well, that's not really trust. It's just too thin a form of trust. Because trust for Hollis must exist when it's not kind of cashed out in these consequentialist terms, if you want. It must be the notion that we promise to trust one another independently of what that means in terms of our interests.
Yeah.
Now, it's difficult because it doesn't really deal with the question of what happens if it actually became a situation where it went against your interest. He doesn't really deal with that. And I think he sets the bar extremely high in terms of a requirement of trust.
Yes.
But I think if you're going to talk about trust as bond in terms of Hollis, I'm not sure how that would sit theoretically. with the kind of argument that I think belongs closer to Harlan's encapsulated interest model. So I mean, just sort of throw some ideas
right.
out here, really, for discussion.
I mean, I think that there's certainly different kinds of trust, and I notice that actually when we're dealing with institutions, we do, when possible, prefer to deal with individuals in them. That's to say, in a bank, one used to be able to go and see the bank manager and talk to the bank manager. You certainly can't do that nowadays. Look at you. But that used to be an important way of doing it. If you've got to deal with the Social Security office, I'm sure virtually every client would say they prefer to talk to the same person each week rather than to a different person each week, probably behind a glass screen. This is what Giddens calls an access point, which helps to create... It helps you to trust institutions through a personal bond. And I can certainly see that personal relationship makes these things easier. It's ultimately a question of definition, I think. I do admit that I'm using the word trust quite broadly. And although I think there are distinctions between trust and confidence, trust and faith, trust and belief, trust and acquiescence and so on, there are distinctions. I nevertheless think it makes sense to treat them as part of the same semantic map. In fact, I've drawn up a semantic map with trust at the centre and some of these various concepts around the outside. Because I think to try and insist on the distinctions between these terms is not terribly productive. That in fact, one's dealing with cognate areas of human experience, and whilst remaining aware of distinctions, it seems to me one shouldn't overemphasize them. That's what I would say. But I do admit that this is probably one of the reasons why, although a lot of people are writing about trust, it hasn't much penetrated, I think, the wider world. That's to say, you don't find much about it in newspapers, you certainly don't find government officials talking about trust, whereas they do apply quite a lot of other social science terms. I think it is true that we haven't yet reached any kind of social science consensus about what trust means. We have these kind of disagreements every time two people get together to talk about trust. So that does make it difficult.
I think it's interesting as well, because it's seeping out increasingly now into the international political realm. Like UK government people were starting to use this language in the international area, particularly in the nuclear area.
Yeah.
And I was saying about these speeches in the House of Lords a few weeks ago,
people
talking about trust. Mm. But the worry is, I mean, this is one of Ken's concerns about it, the worry is that maybe they're co-opting the language.
Yeah.
Because it makes them look good using this kind of language. But actually, they're using trust in a much more narrow, instrumental way to legitimise their projects, which are actually probably the converse of trust.
Never trust politicians who talk about trust.
That's the blue bumper stick alive.
I've just been reading an article on that very subject by Uta Freimuth, who's a German historian working on trust. And that's exactly what she's called. Her article, Never Trust Politicians Who Talk About Trust.
Oh, really?
That's the title of her article. Of course, and it's terribly topical right now, isn't it? I mean, and these kind of crises are pretty serious because, in fact, most of the time, with a certain reserve, we do actually in practice trust our politicians. I mean, I know that sometimes people look at you incredulously and say, on the whole, we do trust politicians, but on... practically speaking, we do. We may, at dinner parties, express distrust in them, but in actual practice, we do expect them to conduct themselves with a reasonable degree of morality and competence. And we now know that both bankers and politicians are less trustworthy than we thought them to be, and that's a pretty serious matter. I mean, it really does weaken social bonds. Yeah.
I would like to ask you more about what you mean by the broadening and democratization of trust.
Right.
Because it seems to me that the way you speak about trust, it's a unit level property, so it's an individual's trust. So trust belongs to individuals. But at the same time, you speak about it as something that could be grown or dispersed broadening and democratization of trust of something that in other sense is a property of individuals who either trust or don't. So I wonder what, you know, I would like to know more what you mean by broadening and democratization.
Well, I'm actually talking a lot about structures of trust, that's to say the social configurations which make it possible for people to trust other people and institutions. So I'm definitely not only talking about individuals trusting. I'm talking about the way all or most of us react to certain social situations, certain institutions, and so on. So when I talk about the broadening of trust, I really mean the broadening of the radius of trust. I mean, just to take one obvious example, during the Second World War, in the combatant nations of Europe, most people put their trust in their own nation and the government of that nation and the army and navy and so on of that nation. That's overwhelmingly where people's trust was directed. Pretty soon after the end of the war, the radius of trust was broadened, partly through the international reforms that I've talked about, that made it possible to do things like set up the European Coal and Steel Community, later on the European Economic Community, to operate institutions like the International Monetary Fund and so on, which would have been inconceivable in the 1930s and 40s. That's a broadening of the radius of trust. And then by democratization, I mean that it should be broadened in such a way that it's more inclusive of people lower in the social scale, less privileged, poorer, more disadvantaged. I mentioned earlier on the very unequal, polarized society of Britain in the 18th century. During the 19th century, Disraeli talked of two nations. Such was the polarization that he discerned. By the mid-20th century, I think it is possible to say that most, not perhaps all, but most poorer, disadvantaged people in the UK have been brought into structures of trust, guaranteed by the nation state as public risk manager. So that's what I mean by broadening and democratizing trust. And I am treating it there largely as a social phenomenon rather than an individual.
So what in this has changed to cause the change in the levels of trust in the society that you spoke about? Because it seems to me that, you know, if trust is a product of broadening and democratization of some structures, which you present as a process,
it's a historical product,
in the 1950s, people generally trusted more than they do today.
Yeah.
When we have not witnessed any decrease in the broadening and democratization of the structures. In fact, you might argue that the structures that you refer to are more inclusive and have been democratized?
Well, first of all, the international financial institutions, which operated, I would say, in the 1950s, roughly as conceived, have definitely not been operating in that way in the 1980s and 90s. They've been operating in such a way as to make the poorer world poorer, by and large. And that's true of, international trade agreements and so on, as well as the international institutions. Within Britain, as I say, the deregulation of finance in the 1980s certainly led to a greater polarization of society and to lower levels of trust among poorer people. You know, they were more disadvantaged than before, or at least they saw others becoming more advantaged and them themselves being left behind. And as Richard Layard suggests, Richard Wilkinson in his recent book, we're really talking about comparative levels here as much as anything else. So that where social changes create greater inequality, both between nations and within nations, they lower levels of trust. So that actually, I would say that there has been a narrowing of boundaries of trust, certainly in some countries and internationally in recent decades.
Okay, for the final question, go to Chris.
I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about the role of technology and the social bonds of trust. And that just came into my head when we were talking about you used to be able to go see the bank manager, but now you can't. And I think I really prefer to do my banking online now because I can verify completely between me and the computer what's going on. And
when
I go to the bank, sometimes I'm wondering whether they've told me the right thing when I talk to the person at the bank. And that's why I want a receipt, or that's why I want, you know, some extra review. And I was just wondering, do you see technology decreasing trust because it depersonalises society, or increasing trust because it allows further verification?
Do you know, I think it does both. I mean, I think the nature of trust changes. I mean, I'm very struck by the way, in the modern world, thanks to email and all this kind of thing, we sometimes know people in Los Angeles or Peking better than we do people who live next door to us, you know, because we're in constant email contact with these partners abroad. But it's a different kind of trust. It's not the kind of trust that's mediated through body language or shaking hands or, you know, kindly looks. These personalized forms of trust. And that's one of the reasons why I say that trust in the modern world tends to become thin. In a sense, it's trust. I mean, when somebody invites me to a conference in, I don't know, Moscow, I'll probably accept because I perhaps know them distantly, and I trust them to make arrangements so that I'll be properly put up and so on and there, and the conference will be interesting and so on. So I'm putting some trust in them on the basis of probably not quite sufficient evidence. When it comes to banks, yes, I'm very struck by what you say there. It's obvious that the reason and the way in which we trust banks have changed enormously. It's no longer mediated through the manager or through an individual that we know. It's mediated through computers. And some people like me find that rather frustrating and difficult. I mean, because computers are actually extremely authoritarian. Yeah, you can only answer questions in certain ways. You can only answer questions in certain orders. If you get something wrong, it's very difficult to rectify it and so on. So I think actually computers tend to be rather rigid and authoritarian in their treatment of us, more so than people whom you can talk to. You can't ask a question of a computer and get a sensible answer anyway. Or at least maybe it's my, you know, clumsiness of dealing with computers, certainly I can't. So at the very least, I would say it changes the nature of trust. It thins it. Now, that may work reliably, and it quite often does indeed, and of course it's increased our possibilities hugely. We can be in contact with far more people in the world by using emails, because emails are much simpler to use, and faster, and so on and so forth, than any other form of communication. But at the same time, it's a different kind of relationship. So it may be trust in some sense, but it's a very different kind of trust. It's ambivalent, I would say, really. Yeah. And some people would definitely say that it implies a diminution of trust. Some people would definitely say that.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank everyone for coming out and for all the questions. And, of course, I'd like to thank Professor Jeffrey Hosking for an engaging and interesting talk.
Thank you.